A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about laser eye surgery for high myopia, past minus 7. He looked into it years ago, remembers it being difficult with a prescription that strong, and he's heard the horror stories about chronic dry eye. But he'd also really love to be free of glasses. So the question is, what's the current state of things? How safe is it now? And what procedures are actually recommended for someone at his level of myopia?
Oh, this is a great topic, and I should mention, DeepSeek V4 Pro is writing our script today, so if anything comes out particularly incisive, you know who to credit.
Though I'll be judging the incisiveness myself, thank you.
If Daniel had asked this even 5 years ago, the answer would have been meaningfully different. The landscape for high myopia correction has shifted pretty dramatically. The big shift is that for prescriptions beyond minus 7, the conversation has largely moved away from corneal laser procedures as the first choice option. It's not that LASIK and its cousins can't do it. They can in some cases. But the consensus has been tilting toward the implantable Collamer lens, or ICL, a fundamentally different approach.
We're talking about putting a lens inside the eye rather than reshaping the surface.
And that distinction matters enormously for safety, recovery, and especially the dry eye problem Daniel's worried about. There are really three buckets here. First, the corneal laser procedures, LASIK, PRK, and a smile. Third, refractive lens exchange, which is essentially cataract surgery before you have cataracts. Each has a different risk profile for high myopes.
Let's start with the lasers, since that's what most people think of. Where do those stand for someone at minus 7 or worse?
LASIK is generally approved up to around minus 12 diopters in the United States, depending on the laser platform. But approval doesn't equal recommendation. The issue isn't whether the laser can remove enough tissue. It's whether you have enough corneal thickness to safely remove that much without destabilizing the cornea.
At minus 7 and beyond, you're removing a lot of tissue.
The rule of thumb is roughly 12 to 14 microns per diopter. At minus 10, you're removing around 120 to 140 microns. The average cornea is about 550 microns thick. You need to leave at least 250 to 300 microns of untouched posterior bed for structural integrity. Do the math, and you see how quickly you run into the limits.
The cornea literally becomes too thin to be stable.
That's where you get into the risk of ectasia, progressive bulging and thinning that can leave you worse off than you started. It's rare, but devastating when it happens, and the risk goes up meaningfully when you're ablating deep into the stromal bed.
What about PRK? No flap, so presumably you're not compromising the same structural layer.
PRK avoids the flap complication, but it doesn't avoid the tissue removal problem. You're still ablating the same amount of corneal tissue, just on the surface. PRK for high myopia is actually quite effective optically, but the recovery is rougher, and the risk of corneal haze goes up with deeper ablations. Most surgeons will steer a minus 9 patient toward ICL rather than PRK these days. S-Smile. Small incision lenticule extraction is less invasive than LASIK because the incision is tiny, only about 2 to 4 millimeters with no flap. It's approved for myopia up to around minus 10 in many jurisdictions. The dry eye profile is better than LASIK because you're cutting far fewer corneal nerves, but it has the same fundamental tissue limitation. For very high corrections, the lenticule gets quite thick, making the surgery technically more challenging.
All the laser approaches run into a wall around the same place. You're asking the cornea to give up too much tissue.
And this is the single biggest thing that's changed over the last decade. 10, 15 years ago, surgeons were more willing to push LASIK to its limits. Some of those patients did fine, some didn't. And the ones who didn't had very few good options for repair. The field has gotten more conservative and, I'd argue, more responsible about saying no to poor candidates.
Which brings us to ICL. What is it exactly?
The implantable Collamer lens is a tiny flexible lens. Think of it as a contact lens that goes inside your eye rather than on the surface. It's inserted through a small incision, placed behind the iris and in front of your natural crystalline lens. It doesn't replace anything. It just adds a permanent corrective lens exactly where you need it.
It's not new, right? I feel like I've been hearing about implantable lenses for years.
The first ICLs were implanted in the mid-90s, but the technology has gone through several generations, and the current version, the Vision ICL made by Star Surgical, is dramatically more refined than what was available even a decade ago. The big innovation was adding a tiny hole in the center of the lens, the aquapore, or central port. That eliminated the need for a peripheral iridotomy before surgery.
Iridotomy being where they laser a hole in your iris to allow fluid circulation.
And that was one of the more off-putting parts of the earlier procedure. The central port design lets aqueous humor flow naturally through the lens itself, so you don't need the iridotomy anymore. That change alone made the procedure much more appealing.
What's the correction range on ICL?
This is directly relevant to Daniel's question. The current ICL is approved in the United States for myopia up to minus 20 diopters. That's dramatically beyond what any corneal laser can touch. For someone at minus 7, minus 8, minus 10, ICL is well within its comfort zone.
How does the surgery actually work?
It's an outpatient procedure, typically 20 to 30 minutes per eye. They do one eye at a time, usually a day or two apart. You're awake but sedated. The surgeon makes a tiny incision at the edge of the cornea, about 3 millimeters, inserts the folded lens, positions it behind the iris, and you're done. No stitches needed because the incision is self-sealing. Visual recovery is remarkably fast. Most people see quite well the next day.
The big question Daniel has, dry eye. What's the story there?
This is one of the strongest arguments for ICL over LASIK, especially for high myopes. LASIK causes dry eye because creating the corneal flap severs a large number of corneal nerves. Those nerves sense dryness and trigger tear production. They do regenerate, but it can take months to years, and for some patients, they never fully recover. The deeper the ablation, which you need for high myopia, the more nerves you sever.
The dry eye risk scales with the prescription.
For someone at minus 7 or worse, you're in the higher risk category. With ICL, the corneal nerves are largely untouched. The incision is tiny and at the periphery. The dry eye profile is dramatically better. There's still a risk. Any eye surgery can cause temporary dryness, but the incidence of chronic, bothersome dry eye is much lower with ICL than with LASIK.
That seems pretty decisive for someone specifically worried about long-lasting dryness.
It's a major factor. But there are other risks with ICL that are different from laser risks. The big one is cataract formation. Because the lens sits right in front of your natural lens, if it's sized incorrectly or positioned poorly, it can touch the natural lens and trigger cataract development. The early ICL models had a higher rate of this. The current models, with better sizing algorithms and the central port design, have brought that risk way down, but it's not zero.
How low are we talking?
Published data on the current generation ICL suggests clinically significant cataract formation rates well under 1% over 5 to 10 years, the FDA-A. Clinical trial data for the Vision ICL with the central port showed zero cataracts in the study period, but those studies aren't enormous and we need more long-term data. Real-world registry suggests the rate is very low, but not zero.
What about increased eye pressure, glaucoma?
That's the other one to watch. Any implanted lens can affect aqueous humor flow and raise intraocular pressure. The central port was specifically designed to address this, and it works well. But you still need regular pressure checks after surgery, and there are rare cases where the lens needs to be removed or repositioned.
What about the third option, refractive lens exchange?
Refractive lens exchange, or RLE, is basically cataract surgery before you have cataracts. They remove your natural crystalline lens and replace it with an artificial intraocular lens that has your prescription built in.
Why wouldn't everyone with high myopia just do that?
Because you lose accommodation. Your natural lens can change shape to focus at different distances. When you replace it with an artificial lens, you lose that ability permanently. For someone in their 20s or 30s, which I believe Daniel is, that's a huge sacrifice. You'd need either monofocal lenses set for distance with reading glasses or multifocal lenses, which have their own trade-offs in night vision quality and contrast sensitivity.
RLE is more of an option for someone in their 50s or 60s who's already losing accommodation anyway.
For a younger patient with high myopia, RLE is rarely the first choice, unless there's some other reason, like early cataract formation, or a cornea too thin for laser, and an anterior chamber too shallow for ICL. It's a backup option, not a primary one.
What about the combination approach? ICL and then fine-tune with laser afterward.
For extremely high prescriptions, think minus 15, minus 18, ICL alone might not get you all the way to Plano. In those cases, you can do a light touch-up with LASIK or PRK on top of the ICL, but at minus 7 to minus 10, that's usually not necessary. A single ICL typically gets you to within a quarter diopter of target.
For Daniel's prescription range, bioptics probably isn't relevant.
A well-calculated toric ICL, if he has astigmatism, or a standard spherical ICL should handle minus 7 to minus 10 completely.
What about actual visual quality? I've heard that laser procedures can sometimes produce better acuity because you're shaping the cornea itself rather than adding an optical element.
That used to be the argument, but the data doesn't support it anymore with modern ICLs. In fact, some studies show ICL outperforms LASIK for high myopia in contrast sensitivity and night vision quality because you're not inducing the higher order aberrations that come with altering the corneal shape.
You might actually see better with ICL than with glasses.
It's not uncommon. Glasses for high myopia introduce their own optical distortions, minification, peripheral aberrations, the cosmetic issue of thick lenses making your eyes look small. ICL eliminates all of that. Patients often report that the quality of vision is better than what they had with glasses or contacts.
What's the downside?
Cost, for one. In the United States, you're typically looking at $4,000 to $7,000 per eye, compared to maybe $2,000 to $3,000 per eye for LASIK. It's not covered by insurance in most cases because it's considered elective, refractive surgery.
That's a meaningful difference. What about recovery?
Recovery from ICL is generally very smooth. Most patients are functional the next day. There's usually some mild discomfort and light sensitivity for the first 24 to 48 hours, but it's less painful than PRK recovery and comparable to or easier than LASIK. You need antibiotic and anti-inflammatory drops for a few weeks, and you need to avoid rubbing your eyes. That can displace the lens.
Is the lens removable if something goes wrong?
Yes, and this is another major advantage over laser. LASIK and PRK are irreversible. You've permanently removed corneal tissue. ICL is reversible. The lens can be removed or replaced if needed. It doesn't alter the structure of the eye in any permanent way. For someone who's risk-averse, that's a meaningful psychological benefit, even if removal is rarely needed in practice.
If we're giving Daniel a recommendation, it sounds like ICL is the frontrunner. But what about the specific question of safety in absolute terms?
The risk of sight-threatening complications from modern ICL surgery is extremely low, well under 1 in 1,000 for things like endophthalmitis, infection inside the eye, or retinal detachment. Now, retinal detachment deserves special mention for high myopes. High myopia itself is a risk factor for retinal detachment. The myopic eye is longer than normal, which stretches the retina and makes it thinner and more prone to tears. Any intraocular surgery can slightly increase the risk in the immediate postoperative period, probably due to pressure changes during surgery. The absolute risk is still low, but a high myope needs to know about it and monitor for symptoms, sudden floaters, flashes of light, a curtain or shadow across the vision. Those mean get to a retina specialist immediately.
It's not that the surgery causes the weakness. The underlying anatomy is already predisposed, and surgery can be a trigger.
And that's true for any eye surgery in a high myope, including cataract surgery. It's not unique to ICL.
What about the laser side? If Daniel went to a surgeon tomorrow and said, "I want LASIK for my minus 8," what would a responsible surgeon say?
A responsible surgeon would measure his corneal thickness, map the topography to rule out any irregularity or form-Fruchte keratoconus, calculate the residual stromal bed thickness, and if those numbers are good, they might still offer LASIK. Plenty of minus 8 patients have had successful LASIK, but they'd also have a frank conversation about the higher dry eye risk, the possibility of night vision disturbances, and the irreversible nature of the procedure. Increasingly, surgeons are presenting ICL as the preferred option for this prescription range.
Is there a consensus cutoff?
There's no single bright line, but the general guidance from the American Society of Cataract and Refractive Surgery suggests that above minus 8, ICL should be strongly considered, and above minus 10 is generally the procedure of choice unless there are contraindications. A review in the Journal of Cataract and Refractive Surgery about 18 months ago concluded that for myopia beyond minus 8, ICL offers better safety, better visual quality, and higher patient satisfaction compared to LASIK.
What do the satisfaction numbers look like?
Remarkably high for ICL. The FDA trial data showed over 95% of patients would do the procedure again. Satisfaction scores are consistently in the 95 to 99% range across multiple studies. That compares favorably to LASIK, which also has high satisfaction, usually around 95%, but tends to dip a bit for higher prescriptions.
Any data on regret rates specifically for high myopes who went the laser route?
A UK study a few years back found that for myopia above minus 7, about 8% of LASIK patients reported some level of regret or dissatisfaction, mostly driven by dry eye and night vision issues. The comparable ICL regret rate was around 2%. It's not a randomized trial, so there's selection bias to consider, but the pattern is consistent across multiple observational studies.
Let's talk about night vision. Daniel didn't specifically ask, but it's one of those concerns that floats around. Starbursts, halos.
Night vision disturbances are possible with any refractive procedure. With LASIK, they're typically caused by the transition zone between treated and untreated cornea, or by decentration of the ablation. For high corrections, the optical zone sometimes needs to be smaller to conserve tissue, which can increase the risk. With ICL, night vision issues are usually related to the edge of the lens optic. If the pupil dilates beyond the optical zone in low light, you can get halos or glare.
How common is that?
With the current ICL design, the optical zone is large enough for most patients, typically 5 to 6 millimeters. Some patients notice halos in the first few weeks or months, but they tend to neuroadapt over time. Persistent, bothersome night vision issues are reported in maybe 2 to 3% of ICL patients. It's not zero, but it's lower than what you'd see with LASIK for comparable prescriptions.
What about the long term? We've got ICL data going back almost 30 years now.
The first ICLs were implanted in 1993, so about 3 decades of follow-up. The long-term data is reassuring. The lens material, collamer, a collagen copolymer, is extremely biocompatible. The body doesn't reject it. It doesn't degrade. There's no evidence of toxic effects on the corneal endothelium, the cell layer that keeps the cornea clear and which doesn't regenerate. Endothelial cell loss over time with ICL is comparable to the natural rate of loss that happens with aging.
That endothelial cell point seems important. If you lose too many, the cornea decompensates and you lose vision.
It's critically important, and it was closely watched in the early ICL studies. The concern was that a lens in the anterior chamber might accelerate endothelial cell loss. The data has been reassuring. The annual rate of endothelial cell loss after ICL is similar to the normal age-related loss of about 0.5 to 0.6% per year. There's no cliff.
If Daniel goes the ICL route, what does the actual process look like from consultation to final follow-up?
Step 1 is the comprehensive evaluation. They'll measure everything: refraction, corneal thickness, topography, anterior chamber depth, endothelial cell count, retinal exam. The anterior chamber depth is a key measurement. You need enough space between the cornea and the natural lens to safely accommodate the ICL. The minimum is typically around 2.8 millimeters.
If you don't have enough depth,
then ICL is off the table, and you're looking at either laser, if your cornea allows it, or RLE. But most high myopes actually have deeper anterior chambers because the eye is elongated, so this is rarely the limiting factor.
The evaluation clears him.
The lens is custom ordered based on his exact measurements. That takes a week or two. Then surgery day, one eye at a time. He'll get dilating drops, topical anesthetic, maybe a mild oral sedative. The procedure itself is quick. Most patients say it's strange but not painful. There's a microscope light, some pressure sensations, and then suddenly it's done. A shield goes over the eye, and he goes home.
Same day visual improvement.
The eye is still dilated, and there's some corneal edema, so it's not the final result. But many patients can already tell the difference. By the next morning, the vision is usually quite good and continues to stabilize over the first week or two.
The other eye follows shortly after.
usually within a week. Doing them on separate days is standard to minimize the risk of bilateral complications. If something were to go wrong, and again, it's very rare, you don't want it in both eyes simultaneously.
What about the practical stuff? Can you feel the lens in your eye?
The lens has no nerve endings, and it's positioned behind the iris where there's no sensation. Patients cannot feel it. They can't see it in the mirror either unless you're an eye doctor looking through a slit lamp.
What about contact sports?
Unlike LASIK, there's no flap to dislodge and no weakened cornea to rupture. The eye is structurally intact. If you take a direct hit, you could still get a traumatic cataract or retinal detachment, same as any eye. But the ICL doesn't add any specific vulnerability.
Is there anything on the horizon that might make Daniel want to wait?
There's always something on the horizon. The next iteration of ICL will probably have an even larger optical zone. But the current version is very mature. We're not talking about a technology that's going to be obsolete in 2 years. This is more like buying an iPhone. There will always be a new one next year, but the current one is excellent and will serve you well for many years.
What about the laser side? Anything coming that would make LASIK or SMILE more viable for high prescriptions?
The main development is something called LIRA-K, laser-induced refractive index change. Instead of ablating tissue, it uses a femtosecond laser to change the refractive index of the corneal tissue itself, writing a lens prescription directly into the cornea without removing anything. It's been demonstrated in animal models and early human trials. If it pans out, it could handle higher prescriptions without the tissue removal problem.
How far out is that?
Probably 5 to 10 years from broad commercial availability, if it works. I wouldn't wait for it. There have been a lot of next big things in refractive surgery that didn't materialize. ICL is here now. It's proven, and the outcomes are excellent.
Let me try to synthesize a recommendation for Daniel. He's at -7 or worse. He's worried about dry eye. He wants to get rid of glasses. What's the bottom line?
First step is to find a good refractive surgeon and get a comprehensive evaluation. Not a LASIK mill, a real medical practice that offers the full range of options, including ICL. The evaluation will answer the key questions. Is his cornea thick enough for laser? Is his anterior chamber deep enough for ICL? Does he have any retinal issues that need addressing first?
Assuming the evaluation comes back clean for everything.
Then ICL is very likely the best recommendation for his prescription range. It avoids the dry eye problem, it's reversible, the visual quality is excellent, and the safety profile is strong. The main downside is cost. If cost is prohibitive and his cornea measures well, SMILE or PRK could be reasonable alternatives, with the understanding that dry eye risk is higher and the result is permanent.
Between SMILE and PRK for a high myopia, which would you lean toward?
SMILE, if he's a candidate. The dry eye profile is better than LASIK, the recovery is faster than PRK, and the biomechanical stability of the cornea is better preserved. But not everyone is a SMILE candidate, and not every surgeon offers it. PRK remains an excellent option optically, but the recovery is genuinely unpleasant for the first few days. The corneal epithelium is removed entirely and has to grow back. For the first 2 or 3 days, it feels like there's sand in your eyes. Light sensitivity is intense. Vision is blurry. You're on pain medication and lying in a dark room. Most people are functional by day 4 or 5, but those first few days are not trivial. With ICL, you largely skip all of that.
For someone with a busy life and limited tolerance for downtime, ICL wins on recovery too.
ICL recovery is more like LASIK recovery. You're back to normal activities within a day or two. For a working parent with a young child, which describes Daniel, ICL's recovery profile is a meaningful advantage.
Let me ask one more safety question, and I want to be blunt. What's the risk of going blind? That's what people really want to know.
The risk of legal blindness, vision of 20 over 200 or worse that can't be corrected, from ICL surgery is extraordinarily low, on the order of 1 in 10,000 or less. The main threats would be endophthalmitis, a severe intraocular infection, or a retinal detachment that isn't treated promptly. Both are rare, and both are treatable if caught early. The risk is not zero. No surgery has zero risk. But it's in the same ballpark as the risk of serious complications from contact lens wear over a decade or two.
That's an interesting comparison. Contact lenses aren't risk-free either.
They're not. Long-term contact lens wear carries a real risk of corneal infection, neovascularization, and in severe cases, corneal scarring that can permanently reduce vision. The annual risk of microbial keratitis in daily soft contact lens wearers is about 2 to 4 per 10,000. For extended wear, it's higher, around 20 per 10,000. Over decades, the cumulative risk is not trivial. So when people frame surgery as risky and contacts as safe, they're not comparing like with like.
Surgery concentrates the risk into a single event with a very low probability of serious harm, whereas contacts spread a low but not zero risk over many years.
That's exactly the right way to think about it. And glasses, of course, are the zero risk option in terms of eye health. But they come with the quality of life trade-off that's motivating Daniel to look into this in the first place.
Let's talk about that quality of life piece. What does freedom from glasses actually mean for someone at -7 or worse?
It's hard to overstate. At -7, your uncorrected vision is roughly 20 over 800. You can't see the big E on the eye chart. You can't recognize faces across a room. You can't find your glasses on the nightstand without already wearing your glasses. Swimming is a blur. Waking up in the middle of the night is disorienting. Travel means carrying backup glasses and worrying about losing or breaking your primary pair. The dependency is total.
High myopes are completely non-functional without correction.
So the gain from successful refractive surgery is proportionally enormous. It's not like going from -1 to 0, where you were mostly functional anyway. It's going from functionally blind to fully sighted without aids. Patients describe it as life-changing, and I don't think that's hyperbole.
I'd imagine there's also a psychological component. The constant low-level anxiety about what happens if your glasses break.
I've had patients tell me they used to have nightmares about being somewhere without their glasses. After surgery, those go away. It's a profound sense of liberation.
The case for doing something is strong. The question is just which something.
And the answer, for Daniel's prescription range, is almost certainly ICL, assuming the evaluation confirms he's a candidate. It's the procedure that best balances safety, visual quality, recovery time, and the specific concerns he raised about dry eye.
What about finding a surgeon?
He wants someone who does a high volume of ICL specifically, not just LASIK. The ICL procedure has its own learning curve. A surgeon who does 10 ICLs a year is not the same as one who does 200. He should ask directly about volume, complication rates, and how many of their ICL patients are in his prescription range. A good surgeon will be transparent about all of that.
Presumably, he's in a good location for this. Jerusalem has excellent ophthalmology.
There are several very strong refractive surgery centers. He should be able to get a high-quality evaluation without traveling far.
Let me make sure we've hit all of Daniel's questions directly. Safety. The risk of serious complications is very low, on the order of 1 in 10,000 or less for sight-threatening events. Dry eye. ICL largely avoids the corneal nerve damage that causes post-LASIK dryness. Recommended procedures. ICL is the front-runner for -7 and above, with ESMIL or PRK as alternatives if ICL isn't suitable, and RLE as a backup for specific situations.
That's a solid summary. The only thing I'd add is that the evaluation is the most important step. All of our discussion is based on averages and typical cases. Daniel's individual anatomy might steer the recommendation in a different direction. He needs the measurements.
He should go in informed, which I think we've helped with. He'll know the right questions to ask.
The worst position to be in is sitting in a consultation and not knowing enough to evaluate what you're being told. Daniel will go in knowing the landscape, the trade-offs, and what a responsible recommendation sounds like.
Now, Hubert's daily fun fact.
In the late 1600s, naturalists documented a carnivorous plant on the island of Tuvalu that appeared to preferentially trap insects during the hottest part of the day, but only when the tide was out, suggesting a hunting rhythm tied more to salt spray avoidance than to light or temperature alone.
That plant had a more sophisticated scheduling system than I do.
A tide-aware carnivorous plant. I have so many questions, and none of them are answerable.
To wrap up, the field of refractive surgery for high myopia has matured. What was a difficult edge case 15 years ago is now routine. The technology exists, the safety data is strong, and the quality of life improvement is substantial. Daniel's in a good position to make this decision.
The one forward-looking thought I'd leave him with is this. The ICL is in there for life unless you choose to remove it. But it doesn't burn any bridges. If something better comes along in 20 years, you've still got an intact cornea and your natural lens. You've kept your options open. That's a nice position to be in.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping this operation running. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back with another one soon.
Take care, everyone.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.